All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have a very special show for you today. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time introducing it because we got a whole lot to present and a whole lot I know you want to hear. So we'll get into that very, very, very quickly. But a few words on what the show's about today. A number of years back, Carl Dix and Cornel West, two of the most radical public intellectuals in the country today, began a series of dialogues. It started around dialoguing around the question of Obama and what that meant for the masses of black people, as well as for the country as a whole in the world. And the dialogue has continued since then. And it's been focused up since then around this theme, which is, in the age of Obama, police terror, incarceration, no jobs, miseducation, what future for our youth? And the latest edition of this dialogue occurred on December 2nd up at the University of California, Berkeley. That's right, Berkeley. And it drew out more than 1,000 people in the main ballroom and 1,000 or more in various overflow rooms. And it caused quite an uproar across the campus and throughout the city of Berkeley and the Bay Area as a whole. All right, so we're going to be bringing you excerpts from that dialogue. And just to give you an overview, what you're going to hear today is we're going to have first a short excerpt from the speech given by Carl Dix. And then we'll have a short excerpt from the speech given by Cornel West. And after that, we'll feature some of the questions that were posed to the speakers by the audience members. So it's going to be a hell of a show. I think you're really going to like it. Now, first up is Carl Dix. Carl's a longtime revolutionary and a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, USA. In 1970, Carl was one of the Fort Lewis Six. Those were six GIs who refused their orders to go to Vietnam, and Carl ended up doing 2 years in Leavenworth Military Penitentiary for his stand. In 1985, Carl initiated the Draw the Line Statement, powerful condemnation of the bombing of the Move House in Philadelphia. In 1996, Carl was a founder of the October 22nd Coalition to Stop Police Brutality. Carl also coordinated the Katrina hearings of the 2006 Bush Crimes Commission. So here's Carl Dix from the December 2nd dialogue with Cornel West at UC Berkeley.
First off, I want to read another quote from Bob Avakian called Three Strikes. It gives us a historical perspective on this. The book by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, has shined a bright and much needed light on the reality of profound injustice at the very core of this country. And this brings me to a very basic point. This system in this country, in the whole history of its treatment of black people, what has it been? First slavery, then Jim Crow, segregation and Ku Klux Klan terror, and now the new Jim Crow, police brutality and murder, wholesale criminalization and mass incarceration, and legalized discrimination yet again. That's it for this system. Three strikes and you're out. Now I want to focus on and talk a little bit about that last part that he talked about, the new Jim Crow, police brutality, legalized discrimination, wholesale criminalization. But I want to get at what's behind that, what creates the situation out of which that came. See, and got to go back to the post-World War II period, when large numbers of black people left the rural South, migrating into cities across the country, looking for better opportunities for themselves and their families. Now, what they found was continued discrimination and employment in factories, but in the lowest paying, dirtiest, and most dangerous jobs. But then you come up to today, and even that has disappeared. Those factories have been mostly closed down, shipped halfway around the world by capitalists in search of greater profits through subjecting the workers in those lands to even more vicious exploitation than they could do to people here. That means that you've got people in these inner cities who are facing deprivation and punishment. Government economists project that fully half of inner city youth will never find legitimate employment. What does this mean? It means that a lot of our youth face futures of looking for some hustle or other to try to get by, fighting and killing each other, going in and out of prison, or maybe joining the military and becoming a killing machine for this system. That's the kind of future that our youth are up against. Now, we know a lot of our youth are into some bad stuff. We're clear on that. But we got to get clear on what's the source of this. What's responsible for this? And the reason we got to get clear on that is that we got a lot of people telling us it's the youth's own fault. You know, we got Bill Cosby. He says that poor black people are their own worst enemies. He says they have too many children out of wedlock. They don't speak proper English. The men wear their pants sagging down too far, and the women give their children ridiculous names. We also have today more heft given to this blame the poor chorus by President Barack Obama, and especially through his Father's Day speeches, where he says that absent dads are responsible for the problems that our youth face, or where he says that the reason that our youth don't get good education is because the parents won't turn off the TV and make them do their homework. So we got to get clear. Is it our youth's fault? Is it the parents' fault? Are poor black people at fault for this? Well, I see this all a different way, and the best way for me to get at it, I want to read a quote to you from Basics, a book of quotations and short essays from Bob Avakian, and something that I really encourage people to check out. The black people, the youth with their pants hanging down around their knees, their hats on backwards, their swagger, much of which I admire, weren't the ones who picked the jobs up and took them out of the ghetto. The people filling the prisons, the people in the gangs, weren't the ones who took the jobs and moved them away. They were not the ones who, when black people went chasing jobs, relocated them over the decades, discriminated against them, brought the police out to harass them, and made it very difficult for them to get a job and keep a job under those circumstances. None of that was done by the masses whom Bill Cosby so cheaply chooses to attack in this way. These were conditions that were caused by the dynamics of capitalist accumulation in its international dimension as well as within the country, and by conscious policies of ruling class politicians in line with this. That's Brother Avakian on who's responsible. And see, this is important because our youth are responding to situations that they had no control over and they had no complicity in putting into place. But at the same time that I acknowledge this, then I got to bring a challenge to our youth. You didn't create this situation, but you have responsibility to be part of the solution to this situation. You need to stand up. You need to resist these conditions that they bring down on you. You need to fight the power around them. And as you fight, you need to get out of some of that bad shit that you're in and get with the movement for revolution and join the Emancipators of Humanity, because you got responsibility to help us get all of our people out of this madness all around the world. And I think that's an important point that we got to take to people.
A quick reminder, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and what you're listening to now is a short excerpt from the speech delivered by Carl Dix during his dialogue with Cornel West, a dialogue entitled, In the Age of Obama, Police Terror, Incarceration, No Jobs, Miseducation, What Future for Our Youth?
See, and I've been talking some about the way in which the functioning of the capitalist system has brought this situation about, but there's also a mention in this quote about conscious policies of the ruling class. Well, what are those policies? Am I lying up here? No, I am not. Let's go through some of them. There's the 100-to-1 sentencing ratio for crack cocaine and powder cocaine. Our Congress, somebody else's Congress, because it ain't mine, passed a law that said that somebody who gets convicted of possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine, a drug which is widely used in the ghettos and barrios across this country, would get the same penalty as somebody convicted of possessing 500 grams of powder cocaine, a drug that more well-off people use. What are they telling you there? They're telling you that we are criminalizing people in the ghettos and barrios. We're going to throw the book at them. We're going to set the laws up so that it works that way. We could talk about stop and frisk, an official policy of the New York Police Department and police departments in a few other cities This policy empowers the police to stop, demand identification from, and to search people for any reason or no reason at all. And in New York, they are on track, on a pace right now, to stop 700,000 people this year under stop and frisk. 5 out of 6 of the people they stop are Black or Latino. And more than 90% of them were doing nothing wrong when the cops stepped to them and subjected them to harassment and humiliation and maybe a beat down and arrest and maybe even stole their life. This is what you could face through this. And again, it's targeted specifically at Black and Latino youth. We also could talk about just the way that discrimination against Blacks and Latinos is rife in the criminal justice system. The Sentencing Project did a nationwide study of the racial composition of people involved in drug cases. And here's what they found. They found that more than 60% of the people who get arrested for possession of illegal drugs are white. But then they tracked those cases as they went through the criminal justice system, and they found that when you got to who ended up in prison, 75% of the people who end up in prison for drug possession are Black or Latino. We just talking drug possession here. We're not talking about, you know, other crimes of violence. And drug possession is almost half of the people who are in jail, of the 2.4 million people who are in jail in this country. And less than 25% of the people who go to jail for drugs are white. So you start out with a majority white, but then you end up with a majority Black or Latino. And the way you end up there is the discrimination that operates within the criminal justice system. And this is how you end up with racially targeted mass incarceration. 2.4 million people, most of them Black or Latino, being warehoused in prisons across the country. That's how you get there. But then we also got to talk about how people are treated when they're in prison. And they're treated like less than human beings. They're fed food that's barely edible, subjected to arbitrary authority by the guards. Then you have the people who are in the segregation units, what California calls special housing units. These people are held in conditions that fit the international legal definition of torture. Because if you're held in one of those special housing units or SHUs, you are in conditions where you're denied human contact for days, weeks, sometimes months at a time. See, and I'm not just saying you don't get to have your phone call or visit from your families or your lawyer or something like that. They got it set up so you don't even see the person who brings you the food every day. You don't have contact with any other human being. And international law has defined that as torture and banned it for being employed against people who are in prison. But there are tens of thousands of people in prison in this country who are being treated exactly like that, being tortured exactly like that. See, and it's conditions like that that sparked the 2 hunger strikes that prisoners here in California in these special housing units waged over this summer. See, yeah, you got to give it up for that. You know, because this was some heroic action. People who had no other way to stand up and resist, who starved themselves to stand up and say, we will not be treated like this anymore. And that was a very important thing and something that we should take note of, and I'm going to come back to later. Then we have to put on top of this the way people get treated when they're released from prison after they've served their sentences. What does that come down to? You get discriminated against when you go looking for employment. They got a box you got to check that you've been in jail. And checking that box usually means you don't get the job. And if you try to get by and don't check the box and they found out that you have been in jail, that's grounds for firing you. You're denied access to public housing, denied access to government loans. They don't even let you vote. That's what this comes down to. Now, when you put all of that together and link that to the overall discrimination that blacks and Latinos face in this society. It adds up to me like a picture of a slow genocide. And then when you figure the way things are going in this country and the way in which they're whipping up people to get behind even more stringent and vicious forms of punishment. I mean, I'm sure a lot of y'all saw that Republican debate where the moderator happened to mention that Governor Perry from Texas had presided over 134 executions, and the audience interrupted the thing by cheering. Well, people who are going to cheer when they hear that somebody has executed 134 human beings are people who would form a social base for even worse crimes and atrocities carried out against people. And my point in bringing this up is that slow genocide that I talked about could easily become a fast one. This is what we're up against. This is seriously what we're dealing with here. And we have to understand that the conscious policies that the ruling class of this country has developed in targeting black people and Latino people come from something. It comes from them remembering the 1960s. They remembered that back then it was the rising up of black people against the conditions that they faced that sparked a broader revolutionary movement that rocked this whole system back on its heels. They remember that, and they also realize that they're enforcing conditions in the inner cities across this country that are, if anything, worse than those in the 1960s. So they are moving to head off any potential rising up by trying to trap as many of our youth up in the criminal justice system as they can. In a certain sense, they are carrying out a counterinsurgency in advance of the insurgency, aimed at heading this insurgency off. See, so this is what we're up against, and what it comes down to is that there ain't no way you're going to deal with this short of making revolution and getting rid of this system once and for all. That's what it comes down to, sisters and brothers. That's what we're up against, and that's the way we got to move on it. See, and I know a lot of people felt like when they elected Barack Obama that they were doing something to deal with all of this. What black people were up against was going to be dealt with. Immigrants were going to get a decent shake out of this. The wars would be stopped. People thought all of that would go down. But they were wrong. Obama was stepping up to be the main representative, the commander-in-chief for the U.S. global empire. He said he was the best man to keep it in check, keep it in effect, and to keep it working. And see, if he's going to represent the U.S. global empire and everything that it does in this country and around the world, he cannot represent the interests and the needs of the masses of oppressed people here and around the world. That's an important lesson that people have to get, and then based upon getting it, need to act on it. Because see, here is what it comes down to, sisters and brothers, and if you get nothing else out of what I say tonight, I want you to get this. Yes, the world is a horror, a series of never-ending horrors, but things don't have to be this way. Through revolution, communist revolution, we could change all of this. We could end all of these horrors, all of this brutality that I've been talking about here and around the world. That's a fact. We could do that. There's more to it, though. These kind of revolutions have been made before, in China and in the Soviet Union before that, and they achieved many great things. Both of these revolutions have been overthrown, and now capitalism is back in effect in those societies. But the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, Bob Avakian, has done a deep study of those previous revolutionary societies. And through doing that, he's brought forward a new understanding of how to make revolution, and through that revolution, to bring into being a socialist society that is both viable and is in transition to a world where exploitation and oppression has been ended once and for all, a classless communist world. Now, when I say this, I know that for some people, it's like, did I hear that right? Is that man up there talking about communist revolution and saying it's a good thing? Well, yes, I am. And look, and before you say, he must be crazy, doesn't he know that communism failed, that it was a disaster everywhere it was tried? Well, I would ask you to do this. Consider what's the source of that conventional wisdom that communism has failed, and that it's the same people who don't tell you the truth about history, about the current state of society here in this country and around the world, and don't tell you about how it got that way. Those are the people who are telling you communism has failed, and they're lying to you about that too, sisters and brothers.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and what you've just been listening to has been an excerpt from a speech delivered by Carl Dix, a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And that speech was part of a dialogue Carl has been having with Cornel West. And the title of that dialogue is In the Age of Obama, Police Terror, Incarceration, No Jobs, Miseducation, What Future for Our Youth? And for those of you who are intrigued by this dialogue, just a quick announcement. The entire dialogue, almost 3 hours of it, is going to be aired on C-SPAN between now and the end of the year. So check out the C-SPAN website and search for when it's going to show this dialogue between Carl Dix and Cornel West, all right? Don't miss it. It's a really intriguing thing. Next up, we're going to be hearing from Cornel West and a short excerpt from the speech he delivered at this dialogue. But first, we're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Black Conversation from the Rhythm Masters, just trying to throw some funk up in here. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we have a very special show. We're featuring excerpts from a dialogue between Cornel West and Carl Dix that happened up at UC Berkeley on December 2nd. Now, the name of that dialogue was In the Age of Obama, Police Terror, Incarceration, No Jobs, Miseducation, What Future for Our Youth? In the first half of the show, we heard from Carl Dix. Now we're going to hear from Cornel West. Now, Cornel West is one of America's most provocative public intellectuals and has been a champion for racial justice since his childhood. His writing, speaking, and teaching weave together the traditions of the Black Baptist Church, progressive politics, and jazz, not to mention a little bit of funk. He has been praised for his ferocious moral vision, and Dr. West has been teaching at Princeton University for years, but is now moving on to the New York Theological Seminary. So without any further ado, let's listen to Dr. Cornel West.
If you have the courage to accent truth, you're going to have to listen to every voice, because no individual, no group has a monopoly on truth. We need to listen to one another and learn from one another if we're going to organize and mobilize together. Shoot, I'll work with prophetic Mormons if they want to talk about corporate greed and wealth inequality and the role of big money in politics and arbitrary military power and arbitrary police power. It has to do with what kind of human being you really are. What are you willing to sacrifice for? So if you're committed to truth, and the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak, and if you're concerned about justice, and justice is what love looks like in public. So if you love poor people, if you love Jamal on the chocolate side of town, if you love Juanita on the Latino side of town, or Harry on the vanilla side of town, or on the Asian side of town, then you won't talk about justice, because when you love folk, you can't stand the fact they're being treated unjustly. That's what we're here for. That's why I travel the country with this brother. Now, of course, we don't agree on everything. I think he's wrong on the God question. We're going to get into that later. That's all right. And we look at the traditions of Bob Ovechkin and my dear brother Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. We got Erica Huggins here. Where is she? Where is Sister Erica? Put the camera on our dear Sister Erica Huggins. former head of the Black Panther Party, still long distance runner, deep love, committed to truth, got a smile on her face, love flowing out of her soul. We love you. We love you. Yes, we do. Lift every voice. I don't know if Brother Marvin X is here, but I want to acknowledge that, brother. I told him he could read his poem, but I don't know if he made it here or not. He's a student of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Produced Malcolm X. Transformed a gangster named Malcolm Little into one of the greatest black freedom fighters of the 20th century. Malcolm X. Lift every voice. He produced Minister Louis Farrakhan. Lift every voice. Oh, I disagree here. I disagree there. We disagree with most of our professors. We disagree with most of our politicians. Can you keep track of the element of truth that's at work in their language and in their witness? Can you keep track of the element of justice that's in their work and in their witness? That's the challenge. I don't care if you're Palestinian. I don't care if you're Israeli. I don't care if you're Ethiopian. I don't care if you're Guatemalan. If you have the courage to allow suffering to speak, and you're concerned about the sources of social misery, and you see the connection between unjust social structures and unfair structures of domination generating unnecessary social misery, then you're already on the love train. Oh, yes. We need the OJs, don't we? You're already on the love train. And that's my tradition. John Coltrane's a love supreme. It's Curtis Mayfield. It's Aretha Franklin. There's a genius born just down the road named Sly Stone in Vallejo. What did he say? Stand. You've been sitting much too long. There's a permanent crease in your right and wrong. Stand. They'll try to make you crawl because they know what you're saying makes sense and all. Stand, there's a midget standing tall, and the giant beside him about to fall. Stand, there's a cross for you to bear, things to go through if you're going anywhere. Those are not just words to titillate and stimulate. Too many of our young folk are tied into this culture of superficial spectacle where they're told to be human is to be titillated and stimulated. So they become addicted and self-medicated to keep them sleepwalking. No, the Occupy movement is about the awakening. It's about the deep democratic awakening. About those Sly Stone call everyday people. Or those of late J. James Cleveland call ordinary people. If you're fundamentally committed to the preciousness and the pricelessness of ordinary people and everyday people, I don't care what color, I don't care what culture, what civilization, what sexual orientation, it's a human thing. But it begins with those catching hell, those Franz Fanon called the wretched of the earth. And the problem has been in the last 30 years that the framework for those who love poor people and love working people has been pushed to the side. This ice age we have been living in where it's fashionable to be indifferent to poor people. That's why our children, can you imagine? 42% of our precious children of all colors live in or near poverty in the richest nation in the history of the world. That's moral obscenity. That's an ethical abomination. Every American ought to be ashamed to live in a nation where the precious youth of whatever color has to deal with that level of social neglect and economic abandonment. And it's tied to greed, especially corporate greed at the top. So we need to talk about oligarchic power, plutocratic power, billions of dollars at the top, trillions given to those at the top because they too big to fail. As if our precious young people are too little to be highlighted. I don't know about you, I'm tired of that hypocrisy. Investment bankers get in trouble and call for welfare and get trillions of dollars. And our poor brothers and sisters call for help and they're told to be responsible and deal with the consequences of your actions. Nothing but hypocrisy and mendacity.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're featuring excerpts from the dialogue between Cornel West and Carl Dix. In the age of Obama, police terror, incarceration, no jobs, miseducation, what future for our youth? And right now we're listening to the excerpts from the speech delivered by Cornel West.
We don't look deep enough. And it's mainly because we are afraid. We're scared of taking seriously the contribution of black people in this nation. Afraid of it. And it has nothing to do with phenotype. It has to do with courage, vision, presenting an alternative world. The great Shelley used to say poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world in that grand pamphlet. And what did he mean by that? He wasn't talking about versifiers. We heard magnificent poetry. But they weren't just reading verses or saying verses. To be a poet in the most profound sense is to have the courage to unleash your imagination and your empathy. So it's connected to your R-O-O-T-S, your roots, and the R-O-U-T-E-S, the routes for which you go. And if you keep your R-O-O-T-S consolidated and tight, but keep Socratic energy there for self-criticism, then you can go to any corner of the globe. You can go to any nook and cranny of the nation. You can go to a crack house, White House, your mama's house. You still got integrity. You still got dignity. You're still on fire for justice. You still want to tell the truth. Young people are hungry and thirsty for truth and justice. They're tired of the lies they have been bombarded with. They're tired with the dominant culture of clever gimmicks of mass weapons of distraction. See Brother Vincent there. Stand up there, brother. Wrote the classic on funk music. James Brown, George Clinton, Bootsy Collins, Confunction from Vallejo, Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band. And I aspire to be a funk master. Because the funk is about the truth tied to what Samuel Beckett called the mess. What it is to be in time and space, what it is to be in history, the wounds and bruises and scars that all of us have as human beings, and the fact that we all emerge in the funk, namely our mama's womb, but all that blood down there, and some stinking stench. And that one day our bodies will be the culinary delight of terrestrial worms. That's funky too. You're gonna die. And in that move from mama's womb to tomb, what kind of person are you going to be? You ought to come to terms with forms of suffering, come to terms with forms of social misery, and be willing to straighten your backs up. And any time, every day, people straighten their backs up, they're going somewhere, because folk can't ride your back unless it's bent. And that's what's happening today. Folk are straightening up. Tired of wearing the mask, I want to be me. Tired of laughing when it ain't funny and scratching when it don't itch. Oh yes, for the last 35 years, we've told young people in every corner of this nation to do what? Be successful, be successful, be successful. What does success mean? Material toys, title, wealth, power, and being well-adjusted to injustice. Well-adjusted to injustice, well-adapted to indifference. Is that success? I'm old school. My tradition told me to be great. And he or she is greatest among you has to do with the quality of your service to others and the depth of your love for others, beginning with our great gift of our Jewish brothers and sisters to the world, the prophetic tradition. Yes, it's there in Egypt, it's there in Africa, it's there in Asia, but the whole tradition of a set of conversational partners like Micah and Amos and Isaiah and Nahum and so many others saying, to be human is to engage in hesed, loving kindness to orphan, widow, fatherless, motherless, poor, weak, vulnerable. That is a profound contribution. And it's no accident that black people in this particular democratic experiment and empire, because it's simultaneously both, isn't it? For our indigenous brothers and sisters, 1492 inaugurated World War I has been going on ever since. Let us never lose sight of the preciousness of our indigenous brothers and sisters. But at the same time, you had some urban guerrillas who were anti-imperialist. I'm anti-imperialist too. That's why I'm critical of the imperial policies of the United States. It's a question of principle. How come you don't get behind politicians? I get behind principles. I evaluate politicians in light of the principles. Well, if they're black and brown, do you kind of tilt toward them because of that ethnic thing? I'm very, very excited when I see black and brown and yellow folk breaking white supremacist barriers based on principle. Because I hate white supremacy, just like I hate male supremacy. I hate anti-Semitism. I hate anti-Arab racism. I hate anti-Muslim view. I hate homophobia. But at the same time, even when they break those barriers, I want to know what they are doing. What your policies look like. Does it reflect what Amos was talking about when he said, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream? Are you concerned about working people here and around the world? And especially are you concerned about the poor children whose voices rarely get a chance to surface? Thank God for Marion Wright Edelman, been struggling for the last 45 years for our children. What future for our youth? They are 100% of the future. So, Brother West, what are you calling for? Well, one, let me say this, that I am excited about the Occupy movement. I was just in dialogue this with Brother David D. Where's Brother David D? Stand up, Brother David D. He's one of the great freedom fighters here. One of the great freedom fighters around here. Love this brother. And why am I excited? Because it's led by young people. More of them know Lupe Fiasco than they do Donny Hathaway. You need to know both. They know Erykah Badu more than Nina Simone. They need to know both. They need to know about Carole King, James Taylor, Bob Dylan, Peter Seeger. Have a sense of history even as you make history in the present. And it's a beautiful thing for an old school brother like me to see young people disproportionately straighten up their backs and standing the way Sly Stone said, stand in that poetic way of exercising your imagination and your empathy. And you're saying, like my dear brother Carl Dix, we refuse to accept the notion that there's no alternative to the present. We will not defer to the truncated public discourse that says the only limits of our politics is a choice between a mean-spirited, mediocre, mendacious Republican Party and a milquetoast and spineless Democratic Party. We refuse to confine ourselves to that kind of limit. We want something else. We want another world. We want a better world. We want more imagination. We want more empathy. And they say, oh, that's just utopian. You're just dreaming. What's wrong with dreaming? Eugene O'Neill, one of the greatest playwrights in word, just like Stephen Sondheim is our greatest playwright in song. He used to say oftentimes the question of either you dream or you die. And by dreaming, I'm not talking about some kind of cheap utopianism. I'm talking about how you generate hope. And again, I come from a people, black folk, where for so long, the hope was a crime. Can you imagine what it's like? 244 years of slavery. For the very notion of dreaming, end up executed, or later on under Jim Crow, swinging from a tree. Or even in the 1960s, when you really dream like Martin, the FBI keeps track of you every day from January 1956 until your day you die, and you discover that the very photographer with you every day was an FBI informant. Dream or die. And it has to do with the depths of your love. If you're willing to love, you can't help but dream alternative visions to a nightmarish present. And may be confined solely to your side of town, but you're like the canary. Sooner or later, it's going to hit vanilla suburbs too.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Today's show is it's a broadcast of a dialogue between Cornel West and Carl Dix. And that dialogue is In the Age of Obama, Police Terror, Incarceration, No Jobs, Miseducation, What Future for Our Youth? And this dialogue occurred on December 2nd at University of California, Berkeley. And we've just been listening to excerpts from the speech delivered by Cornel West at that dialogue. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with excerpts from the question and answer period that followed the speeches. So stay tuned.
You ready?
Yeah!
Oh, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. Woo!
The name of this thing is Hook and Slay. You got it. Hook it, baby. I'll sling it. Hook it, baby. I'll sling it.
Welcome back. That was The Hook and Sling Part 1 from Eddie Bowe and the Soul. Now let's get back to the dialogue between Cornel West and Carl Dix, and this in particular are some excerpts from the question and answer period.
Okay, so we'll go back to a written question.
Okay.
And this one states, we are taught to be ashamed of our past, of our poverty, ashamed of not being successful. But you, Professor Cornel West, have de-shamed us. Thank you. So the question is, how do we redefine success?
Appreciate the question. One is that, I appreciate the kind words, but no one individual can fully de-shame. That when you look at me, you see the people who love me. You see the people who sacrificed for me, the people who cared for me. I am just one moment in a rich tradition. So all you are getting is just this, these nuggets of wisdom. I just got nuggets. They had huge rocks in the past because they're dealing with levels of catastrophe of slavery and Jim Crow and Jane Crow and self-hatred and self-violation and self-destruction I couldn't even conceive of. But I still want to be connected with them. And I try to get all the wisdom I can. So if I just drop a nugget, that's not just me. That's my grandmama speaking through me. You see? That's Fannie Lou Hamer speaking through me. That's Huey Newton speaking through me. And it's Curtis Mayfield. But the musician speaking through me. So in that sense, we always want to couch it in a tradition, a rich tradition. Then the question of miseducation. There's a qualitative difference between schooling and education. If all you're going to do is just get schooled, then you're going to end up with a skill with the same empty soul, hollow orientation, and moral backwardness, spiritual malnutrition, and moral constipation. But you'll be very smart. And the worst thing that has happened to young people is we've told young people to be the smartest in the room. It's just like that film, The Social Network. Just empty. The smartest in the room. Nazis, some of them were very smart. The defenders of American apartheid, some of them were very smart. They had PhDs from Harvard. But you know what? They were gangsters. They were thugs when it came to the humanity of poor and especially people of color. And there's no monopoly of any one group or race in that regard. So when we talk about de-shaming, all we're saying is we want a holistic, deep education that goes beyond schooling so you connect courage, compassion, bearing witness. Now, what my dear brother calls revolution, I call bearing witness. Because I'm a Christian. Because all I'm going to do before I die is bear witness and go to the coffin. Now, that will involve itself with working with revolutionaries and even being critical of revolutionaries. In light of the love, but bearing witness. And bearing witness is a beautiful thing. There's joy in serving others, and never confuse that with pleasure. We live in a society obsessed with pleasure, and education becomes schooling and miseducation when it's just about your own narcissistic pleasure. But joy is something else. Don't get caught in the joyless quest for pleasure. Get some joy in there.
So you really have soul, like the soul stirs of Lou Rawls and Sam Cooke, rather than just body stimulators of bubblegum music these days among young folk. But we won't get into that right now.
Yeah. I just want to add a story from my own past on this thing of redefining success and greatness.
Yes, yes.
Because when I got the orders to go to Vietnam, I really felt that morally I should not go, and practically it wouldn't be such a good idea, you know, because, no, I'd be shooting at people, and they'd be shooting at me, and I saw some of those GIs that came back from Vietnam, and they had lost their minds. I mean, they were just off. Mm. But the last thing that I had to deal with was I knew my parents wanted me to be successful. Mm. And how could I go to them and say, Mom, Dad, I'm going to jail because I think this is wrong. And even more than that, I think the whole country is wrong. And I think I need to be a revolutionary. And, you know, I thought about that. And I went on leave before it was time to go. And I said, well, I got to tell them. You know, and I told my mother and father, and my mother was worried for my safety. That was always my mother's take.
That's love. That's love, though.
Yes. Yeah, but my father's thing was, do you think this is right? Mm. And I said, I know it's right. And then he said, well, if it's right, then you should do it as well as you can.
Ooh, that's beautiful. You know? That's beautiful, man.
If you're going to stand up this way, then don't stand up half-assed. Go all the way and go as far as you can with it. And that's what people need to do today. They need to get to the truth of something and then act on that truth and act as well as they can, taking it as far as they can. And then also be open to new sources of information and analysis, which might let you know that you was off in one sense or another. Because, you know, you can't proceed like you got 100% knowledge. That would be just objectively not true. The only way you can get as deep an understanding of reality is to be open to other viewpoints, including ones that disagree with you.
So my question in regards to the talks on the Occupy movement that you've referenced earlier, and it seems to be a very pro-Occupy stance, but I feel like some of the other issues that we have been speaking about tonight, race, gender, the prison industrial complex, homophobia, all of these issues don't tie into what I see going on with the Occupy movements and who is out there and who is protesting and what they're standing for. Because from what I see, it's a middle class, white college graduates out there who are upset because there are no jobs. And we see the media paying attention almost as if it was Vietnam again. It's not a problem until it's a middle class problem. And so the power dynamics are still very existent even within this movement. And we look at film from the Occupy Atlanta where John Lewis went to speak. And he wasn't allowed to speak, and he was shut down by a white male who had a megaphone and took several votes, and there was a lot of confusion in the crowd. And so we see this power dynamic with race, again, even within the movement. So I'm questioning whether this is a movement of social justice or if it's about white middle-class people who can't get a job. And, you know, where were they 6 years ago when middle class income was on the rise by 6%, you know, these are issues that people have been facing since the beginning of time. We look at the Native Americans, we look at Latinos, we look at blacks, you know, these are issues that have been going on. Where were they?
Mm-hmm. No, appreciate the question.
Could I say a word about that?
Go ahead. My dear sister, I appreciate that question. It's a very important question. We had magnificent discussions here at Occupy Oakland just a few weeks ago on precisely that issue. But I think, one, we have to be very careful where we get our information from. You see, if you're looking at CNN as opposed to Amy Goodman, you're going to get a very different perspective of who's there. You know what I mean? Or MSNBC or Fox News and so forth, the corporate media tends to be truncated in its representations of the variety and diversity of the Occupy movements. There's a whole lot of different folk out there, large numbers, I mean, a number of them precious homeless brothers and sisters, right there with them, you see. Now, you are right, it's disproportionately young, it's disproportionately vanilla, and 43% of them have been through college a year or two or three. So it's tilted in that way. But you see, when you talk about truth and justice, if it's true and it's just, no matter who says it, it's the issue. You see what I mean? So if they're talking about corporate greed, and corporate greed is pushing the nation to the brink of catastrophe, whoever says it, it's true. You see what I mean? It's true. So that in that sense, you certainly have students concerned about their loans and so on, but that's just one element. One element. You've got anarchists out there who've been organized since Seattle 12 years ago. You've got communists out there. You got Democratic Socialists of America, my own. You got a whole lot of folk. You've got some Christian evangelicals out there. We got Union Theological Seminary, where I'm headed. I just left Princeton, you all know. I'm going back to Union Theological Seminary in New York. We got a Union Theological Seminary occupied chaplaincy of 45 pastors. And they're not there for student loans. You see what I mean? So that I hear what you're saying, the movement must deal with these issues. Of course, it's going to be racism in the Occupy movement. This is America. What you expect? All white folk ain't not going to become John Brown overnight. That's not going to happen. It's not going to become Miles Horton overnight. But if they're trying to fight against racism, you got to help them fight against racism. Come together. Let's fight against this patriarchy. Let's fight against homophobia. Make sure our Jewish brothers and sisters feel open if they're willing to be critical about the state of Israel vis-a-vis the occupation. See what I mean? That's very important. Palestinians, they've got to keep track of the humanity of the Jewish brothers and sisters, and they join too. Because if we're talking about love, justice, and so forth, it's a higher standard for all of us. All of us will fall short. Each and every one of us will fall short, but we know what the standards will be. And that's where we learned the best of what Martin was talking about in the 60s. He said, we need Martin King so bad, and if we could just put a smile on his face from the grave, ooh, that would be a major thing. Because he'd been weeping for 30-some years, every day, every day. Even with black presidents, he's still crying. He is, because he loves the symbolism. But when he looks on the ground and sees the precious human beings dealing with deplorable conditions and circumstances, he's on the love train. He's got that love supreme. He weeps. We got to put a smile on that brother's face. But he is just a moment in a tradition. It goes all the way back, down through the corridors of time.
Yeah,
that was a long answer to that question. I appreciate that question, though, sister.
Let me hit this a little shorter, I hope.
Mm-hmm.
6 years ago, most of the people in the Occupy movement were sleepwalking past the graveyard and everything that was going on around them because things seemed to be going well. Frankly, 3 years ago, a lot of them were swept up into Obama mania. Okay? But at this point, they're opening their eyes to something. They're standing up against some injustice. And my approach to that is, I'm not going to be mad at you because you wasn't there 6 years ago or 3 years ago. I'm going to go to you right now and say you're on to something, but you're not seeing the whole picture. Here's what it looks like. I'm going to go to you with what's happening around the world, that this 99% has to be seen on a global level. I'm going to go to you with what's happening up in Harlem, what's happening over in Bed-Stuy or in the South Bronx. This is going down every day. And if you want to talk about the 99%, you got to say that this section of it over here in the ghettos and barrios are dealing with some things. And if you see that as outside of your issues, you're not relating to the 99%. I'm going to challenge people to not only be true to their principles, but to take those principles and on that basis, dig deeper into reality. I'm going to challenge them to engage this thing of what I have to say about nothing short of revolution can deal with all of this. And then get into all of the political and ideological questions that come up around that. You know, can we organize horizontally? Can we organize at a distance from the state? Well, you tried that at Zuccotti Park and the state came down and sprayed pepper spray in your face. You know, you can't organize at a distance from the state, especially if you're going to look at everything that's going on. You know, the Pakistanis who've been hit with these drone attacks, they weren't trying to get up close to the state. The American global state intruded into their lives, and we have to actually end that. So I'm going to take that to people. And like I say, I'm not going to be mad at them about where they were 6 years ago or even last year. I'm going to be like, here's where you need to be looking now. Here's where you need to be going. Here are some principles, and you need to act on them. You know, and I think that's the approach that needs to be taken on this.
All right. Well, for my money, that was one hell of a show. A dialogue between Cornel West and Carl Dix. And if you want to hear the entire dialogue, remember, C-SPAN is going to be showing it. So go to their website and search for the Carl Dix Cornel West dialogue, and you'll see they're going to show it sometime between now and the end of the year. All right, that just about wraps up our show for today. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my engineer for today, Teddy Robinson, my production assistant, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Reach for the Sky from Social Distortion.
Just a roll of the dice. But the day